Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So, Jupiter, the principle of deep delving excavation, is stationing right now. It will turn retrograde at 8:46 p.m. Pacific time tonight. And I like to think of planets, planetary intelligences, when they retrograde, it is about retrieving guiding wisdom. So, more than perfectly, death, sex, money, power, age, all once sacred, orthodoxed into taboo, now liberated back to vernacular, sacred through the agency of our most skookum guest. Remember that skookum means connected to the spirits and completely competent for the work at hand, Stephen Jenkinson, beloved by many allies, many listeners, many teammates, many clients of mine. Here we go. He is and has been filing scouting reports from the life-death border, guiding us to come of age by honoring age. Stephen is a teacher, author, storyteller, spiritual activist, farmer, and founder of the Orphan Wisdom School, a teaching house and learning house for the skills of deep living and making human culture. It is rooted in knowing history, being claimed by ancestry, working for a time yet to come. He's author of Die Wise, Money and the Soul's Desires, and the forthcoming Come of Age, The Case for Elderhood in a Time of Trouble. His website is orphanwisdom.com. Joining us from Athens, Greece. Yes, welcome, Stephen.
Thank you, Carolyn. How are you doing?
I'm all the better for cahooting with you, and a little shout out to our ally Ted Hargrave, who so wanted us to cahoot. So that's wonderful, and it's perfect, you know, that this intelligence of deep diving into sacred taboo matters is weaving a nest for you and your wondrous work. So you're on the road, Athens and Israel, and then San Francisco in April, right?
Yes, that's the beginning of another torturous year on what I call the Man Killer Tour. It's come into the fourth year of it, and either I got the name wrong or it's just killing me on the installment plan. But either way, it's a great privilege, and I'm lucky to be upright and be alive long enough to go bizarrely international.
Well, that's great. And then just in the realm of reciprocal blessing, you know, radio is magic. And so we wish you surprising, unexpected replenishment from your dedicated travels and good work. So, yes, you refer to yourself as, you know, you have worked in the end of life. You call it the death trade. And we love, you know, reverently irreverent is a liberating spice that you carry. That's really great. And so, you know, this is a democratic show. You can go anywhere you want, regardless of whatever I ask. But I find your work so compelling and pertinent. And I lived with a coyote for 19 years. And when her best friend died, she really taught me the difference between grief and sentimentality. Is that a distinction that you hold?
Oh, yeah. The way sentimentality strikes me is it's a kind of, I'm going to be a little strong on it and say it's a kind of affectation that the troubles of the times don't really tolerate in us at this point. You know, sentimentality, is connected to nostalgia in some fashion, and it's good to be aware of the etymology of this word. Nostalgia doesn't mean sepia-toned images from National Geographic, you know, days gone by. The word actually means the return of pain. Isn't that something to know?
So the return is
kind of revisitation of painful things in a way that leaches out the pain. And I suppose my own take on grief is that, you know, pain is a enabler in a profound but generally unwelcome fashion, and it's a god of sorts. You know, grief is a deity in my understanding, and as such, the approach to it is the thing, not how you feel about grief. Nor is grief itself a feeling. If grief is a deity, then the whole thing comes down to a question of, you know, kind of profound etiquette of the soul. And that's one of the great benefits and privileges I had in that business, was to be deeply educated about that kind of approach, that kind of etiquette. at, you know, one torrid and often heartbroken example at a time over quite a few years. And the sentimentality after that just has no, there's no compelling force or binding force to it to me at all.
Right. And I think sentimentality can sometimes prevent grief, which is authentic, and then really in its deepest level, it is love for something treasured and unique that is gone, these mysteries. So you've
you could say it has its place, but in the same way that training wheels on a bicycle have their place. But it's not really a domain for grown-ups, I would say. And, you know, people listening to that would think, well, who's he to say? And good point. I don't have an answer to that, but I just saw enough people die badly to have given up entirely in the idea that our feeling state is the God.
Right. Well, when we speak of people dying badly, and this is part of your ministry, I do remember when my mom was dying and clearly on her way out, and my sister, who's more Catholic, summoned the priest, and the priest came and prayed for a speedy recovery. And even my sister was like, God, they've turned last rites into a Hallmark card. God, you know. So in this retrieving of, so you've seen people die badly. And I do wonder about, you know, the curiosity of this beautiful planet and nature going birth and death. Why so hard? Why so hard? Even good deaths, so hard. But you mention a lot of your work. You go, there's palliative and numbing people and managing pain and that. But there is something. And you're quite down on that because it makes people inert, right, and absent from the experience. But there is also, I mean, let me toss this to you. I had a friend who was a death and care nurse, and she made speedballs. She made amphetamine heroin for her patients, which she said left them pain-free but lucid in a way that they could converse and be intimate with their loved ones. Is that, you know, how do you feel about that?
Ah, you're drawing me into feelings again, I noticed. Well, you know, my opinions about that or really anything else that we might talk about, I think are irrelevant to almost anybody listening, including myself, actually. So, you know, what you hear me talking about here is really I'm reporting, you know, in as faithful a witnessing sense as I can manage. I'm reporting what I saw. You know, what I was burdened and privileged to be drawn close to. And that's simply, if I can still use the verb to trump, you know, with your audience in a way that doesn't rile everybody
right.
up, that maybe trumps any feeling you might come up with. Just seeing it stills the jangle of conviction, you know, about are you pro, are you con, or any of that stuff. And instead, something else, at least I found, rose up in me that had to do much more with, have you seen enough? Are you going to blink? Are you going to turn away? Are you, what have you been, what's the reason that you've been let in on these things? What are you to do with what was entrusted to you? Things of that kind. You see, so I suppose I have a voice that's maybe closer to exhortation than or some kind of discernment, or at least on my better days. And it's not really burdened very much by, you know, approval or not. And so when it comes to the question of, you know, speedballs, as you say, or euthanasia, or any of those kind of, you know, strong elixirs, the LSD, of course, is enjoying an enormous resurgence now in end of life care and so on. I don't weigh in on this from the point of view of should it or shouldn't it. And to me, it comes down to this. These things are all engaged as things to me as problem solving devices. There are many other things, but that's one of the things that they routinely are. And my want is to wonder what problem are they proposing to solve. So my take on that essentially is that most people died badly on my watch, and virtually none of them chose to do so. And none of the professional people surrounding them opted for that bad death, and yet it proliferated. So how to make sense of this? And all I can come up with is something in the order of most of the solutions to dying that a death-phobic culture generates includes and perpetuates the death phobia. When I take that understanding and apply it to things like, you know, heavy drugs at the end of life and other measures, it seems to me that what they're doing inadvertently is to further the death phobia by reinforcing the idea that death is basically unbearable, intolerable, and shouldn't be countenanced, by delivering us by means, you know, mechanical or drug or otherwise, without really wondering what the, you know, the profound existential and spirit consequences are of engaging in a way of responding to death that still makes death the enemy. So there's my, you know, my 2 cents on the matter, and that's what I have instead of an opinion about it.
That's great. No, and you say a great thing, death as the enemy, and maybe one of the things that we aspire to is to toss our human addiction to having an enemy into the cauldron, as opposed to cooperating with everything in some way, which seems fundamental to your dedication. But you're right, you know, and we do want to get to elders and your exhortation about, you know, come of age, which is a kind of, yes, you're inviting us to come of age, the case for elderhood in a time of trouble. But you do mention that, you know, of course, people's fear of death is a fear of completely disappearing, and then the fear of pain as well. The fear of disappearing, how have you come to dance with that between you and others who are with their fear of disappearing completely?
You mean, what have I tried to do about it?
Or how do you dance with it? You know, a fear of disappearing, that we can relate to that, going, ah, what if I cease to exist? No, I mean, that seems to be the primary fear, right? So how have you been wondering about that fear of disappearing, or guiding or working with people with their fear of disappearing?
I think I've been corroborating that fear, to be frank. In other words, it's an absolutely legitimate fear in the modern Western world to have, as you approach the ending of your days, no matter how old you are, to entertain the real possibility to actually be almost drawn under by the almost inevitable possibility that you will, in every meaningful sense of the term, cease to be, and that the world, even the world that knew you, within a relatively short period of time, will find its way towards proceeding, more or less as if you'd never been. You know, I'm not making that up, and I'm testifying that, you know, not only were people fearful of this, but it was their own life experience that drew them towards that fear as their death came on. And the best way I can give you a feel for, you know, what that looked like on the ground is a strange little vignette that I wrote about in DieWise towards the end of the book, where people who are dying began to make, when the technology became available and relatively cheap, were making home movies, and no doubt continue to do this very thing. And as they made the home movies, of course, the movies are employed to dispense a kind of timeless wisdom or some other such cabal of life assurances and make them available to the, you know, the people that either they won't live long enough to meet or that will outlive them by some considerable degree, to be played at weddings, apparently, and graduations and communions and things of that kind. And, you know, on the surface of it, these things seem to be fairly life-affirming. And certainly they were engaged by the families and by the makers of the films and the rest as being that very thing. If you've been to let's call it a normal funeral lately, probably this very thing appeared, a kind of endless tape loop of visual images on a screen somewhere close to the casket, whether it was open or closed. It's amazing when you think about how, what kind of quote-unquote market penetration this kind of timeless record on the screen currently enjoys. So, you know, to take what I said earlier about the drugs and so on and wonder about this thing, this is what came to me. These people are making these films so that they will appear at these various events they won't live long enough to see. But why are they making the films to guarantee such a thing? Well, I think the evidence is fairly clear. It came down to this. As their dying came on, they began to wonder about the very thing you and I are talking about now, usually involuntarily wondering about it. And as they did so, one of the things they came to realize is when it was their turn to maintain in a deep and consistent way the memory and the presentness of people that they claimed at one time to love or cherish or honor or some combination of all of those things, they realize now how easy it was to, quote-unquote, as they said these days, get on with their lives and to proceed without any necessary recourse to those memories. So they became remembrances. That means involuntary, like reaching in your pants pocket and finding a matchbook and remembering the restaurant and da-da-da-da, that kind of thing, instead of you know, what other cultures have as a kind of ritualized memorial that's recurrent, understanding that being a human being is a pretty rough ride sometimes, and it's not easy to remember things, particularly things that hurt. So all of this is to say that one of the principal aspects of dying badly in the West came down to dying people realizing that when it was their turn to keep their dead ones with them and alive, they realized now that they had failed to do so and pretty consistently failed to do so. And it was only with that realization that they began to see very clearly what was likely waiting for them, the same kind of one-dimensional, everything-but-disappeared status.
Right. Well, let me run this by you. So when my great friend Dr. Wu was dying, he who had helped many people to die and had guided them, he was not happy. He had much fear, and it was not my capacity to provide certainty. He was a great I Ching scholar. It was my capacity to throw the I Ching for him and see what it had to say. But he was hanging in there, and then, you know, we were supporting. But then somebody showed up, a kind of, you know, alternative doctor full of bravado and confidence who just went and said, look, it's fine. The ancestors are waiting. It's time to go. And boom, out he went. So we could not provide that certainty, but Dr. Wu was hanging in waiting for somebody's certainty just in that story. Do you think there's a value to riding out on a story?
Oh, absolutely. But let me come to that certainty question first, if you don't mind. And
sure.
I would say, you know, that certainty of the kind that you referred to there is enormously overrated in a circumstance like you described. Mm-hmm. And more than that, it's utterly not necessary in order to achieve, that's the word I'd like to use, dying well. So, look, you know, if dying is as a deity as well as grief, and I contend adamantly that that's exactly what it is, then it's proper, I think, for us to say that death, including our personal death, absolutely eclipses anything we might have to say about it, any conviction we might bring to it. In that sense, it's very much like marriage. You know, you can recraft your marriage vows if you're so inclined. But this doesn't mean that you're recrafting, quote, marriage. Marriage as a fundamental institution is bigger than what you bring to it. And, you know, a certain amount of humility is not a bad way to come to it. Dying is very similar. You know, in the West, we often use the personal pronoun, my death, really as if there is such a thing. And I suppose my claim would be, no, you know, your death doesn't belong to you. It's entrusted to you. And in that sense, it's not a possession to do with as you see fit any more than this world is our personal possession to do with it as we see fit. So humility, yeah. This is a beautiful antidote to the hankering after certainty that you know what's to become of you. That's not the only alternative to that fear of disappearing that I described earlier. It could be this. The word mystery comes from a Greek phrase which means something very close to it closes the mouth. It's amazing, no? So the gist of it is that there's something about mystery that does two things from the sort of Western habit point of view. One is it thwarts our idea that everything is there for us to consume in some fashion or other. And the second thing it says is, you know, the more you learn about things mysterious, the more mysterious they become. And if you get enough mystery in your craw, it tends to dry up your yammer, you know. And this is very fitting in some fashion, it seems to me, that your convictions wither and your belief systems go the way of the dodo, maybe. And what you're left with is a kind of dumbfoundment that is absolutely part of the natural order of things. It's not supernatural. You're confounded by how utterly both compelling and complex, but remarkably familiar the ways of life actually are. And dying, of course, is in the order of the natural order of things. And when it comes to call, you make up your mind about its meaning to you. But unfortunately, in the West, we often make up our mind in the absence of much direct encounter with dying. We make up our minds in a vacuum of sorts that's kind of tinged with fear, tinged with resentment, tinged with a sense of being ripped off. So what kind of narrative are you going to craft for yourself if that's your basic inheritance when it comes to this mystery?
I love that mystery etymologically, because we are kin in our love of etymology. It closes the mouth, and might we say, because you're right, you say the fabled treasure trove of elder wisdom has not appeared in dominant culture of North America yet. Mm-hmm. And I gather you're aspiring to redress that missing. But we might say, you know, in the modern world, you know, to ancient world, as exactly as you say, certainty was a booby prize and wonder was a great accomplishment. You know, look, Stephen's run out of certainty. Now the divine can find him. The wonder is a big form of participating, in a sense. So you prefer to leave everything really, in a sense, as it is. We don't know. And it's full of wonder, and so in your as a deaf guide, I don't know what your term for yourself is. Are you just a steady presence of? Well, I don't know. You said exhortation before, but that might not be at the right at the last moment. But so what are you holding when you are, and what do you want somebody to hold for you when you die?
Okay, well, the first part first. I'm not sure about the answer to the second one, but I'll work it up as I'm speaking.
Okay, that's good.
My job when I was working in the death trade was to make myself obsolete. It was not to be an enduring presence on the scene. It was not to cultivate a sense of reliance upon me in anyone else, even myself, but certainly not anyone else. Nor to make myself in some fashion or other mandatory, either as a kind of ghoulish, you know, peripheral presence at the foot of the bed, or by virtue of anything I might have said or written or presented or what have you. So you might wonder, Jesus, well, what's left once you cross all those things off the list? And the answer is something in the order of, it seems that my responsibility then and now, even though I don't work in the death trade as I once did, you know, I participated in those days as a human being, and my citizenship in that category has not been rescinded because I'm not hired by the Citadel. I'm still a human being, and my responsibilities pretty much remain the same. And this is what they come to. My job, every time I went to see somebody who was dying and their families, was to find a way to carry myself, and in particular, to speak as if what's happening is happening. This is not to say that I forced anything upon anyone. It's not to say that I didn't. What I'm saying instead is my principal responsibility was to craft a language wherein the realities of dying could actually appear when I was employing that language, so that nobody had to look beyond what I was trying to do and say to look for a sign. Because I assure you, most of the time, people were looking for signs. They weren't persuaded by the information, you see. Being told that you're dying is not the same thing as knowing you're dying. It's not a piece of information that takes enormous range, emotional and a kind of spiritual range, to engage that piece of information until it becomes a kind of meaning-laden consequence for you. I'll tell you a little story. It just happened the other day. I got an email from somebody who I didn't know, I never met. She said, well, here's the thing. My father very recently died. I was with him 3 days before he died. We had dinner together in a restaurant. Neither one of us proceeded like we'd never see each other again, and I never saw him again. He died very unexpectedly, etc. And then the next line was, everything you seem to say and wrote in Diewise seems to presume that everybody knows, you know, that they're dying. What about these people who die suddenly? And my response to her was this: no, nothing I'm talking about assumes that people know they're going to die. What I say instead, and what I'm saying to you now in answer to that question, comes to this. You could know that you will die. You could know that. And knowing seems to me to mean it's going to have discernible consequence in how you carry yourself through your days. That's what knowing means. It doesn't mean suspecting. It doesn't mean fearing. It means knowing. So given that circumstance, I say to her, both you and your father, sitting in that restaurant, enjoying yourselves, could have known, quote unquote, that it is in the cards that he's going to die first. And though you might have no sign of the obvious kind, you still have all the information you'll ever need that there will come a time called the last time. So what are you waiting for? In addition to that information, in order to carry yourself, like the time that you're in when you sit in the restaurant, is as privileged and as burdened by this understanding, and therefore as precious as any other time that you could imagine having would be to you. So there's no such thing, you see, once you understand this, as sudden death. Sudden means I didn't know. And, well, that's called truancy. That something's being held from you. As an adult human being, this understanding is not kept from me. Although you and I would agree, I'm sure, that culturally speaking, there's very little that sustains that understanding or gives us, I mean, we've become a tremendous drag at parties if we conduct ourselves as if what I just said is true. So that's the first answer to the first question. And then the second thing you asked me.
Yeah, and then who do you want at your deathbed? But let me insinuate, Michael Ventura, who wrote with my first radio guest, James Hillman, we've had a 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse. But we kind of cooked up a Scorpio thing. We said, how about we only sleep with people that we would want at our deathbed? We go, boy, that tightens up the standards. So it's an interesting thought. But yes, and then your own deathbed. But in our precious time, I want to also just put on our work altar for us and our dedicated listeners the dedication of your forthcoming book, you know, which will be out in June. And I gather people are pre-ordering right now. And I read the excerpt that you sent me, Come of Age, The Case for Elderhood in a Time of Trouble. So this returning... Well, it's okay. So the time before we die, right, and leaving out sudden death and guns and accidents and all kinds of things, but that this realm that you are dedicated to now, which is the case for elderhood, or however we want to term that, in a time of trouble, meaning the value of older people, and you mentioned all the things that we know, you know, the exile into senior centers, the, you know, the expense, the all those things. So what is your and anything you want to, any way you want to respond is completely great. But what is your exhortational, fervent wish about elderhood? What is the case for elderhood? You know, and how would we cultivate that now?
How many minutes we got left?
With 8. but this is part one. This is part one, Stephen. Sorry, say what?
Yeah, I wrote a 400-page book to answer this question. So let me see
Excellent.
If I can do a little bit of justice in the time that we have left. First of all, my countryman, recently departed, Leonard Cohen, said it so beautifully and so properly. He said, "Ah, my love, be not afraid. We are so lightly here. It is in love that we are made. In love, we disappear." So that's the coda on the end of my last answer. Now, to come to what you've asked me here about elderhood. Well, I got to set it up a little bit. First of all, the observation, it's not certainly not mine. I'm not the first, the only, or in a particularly innovative way saying it. But we know in North America it's an aging population. We know the bulge has hit its 60s and its 70s. We know that it's drawing down the lion's share of the... resources, financial, emotional, and otherwise, of the dominant culture of North America, and it's still having its way, amazingly so. And so for all of that, we have more old people per square foot in North America than there have ever been anywhere on the planet. I'm fairly sure that's true. At the same time, we should make a corollary observation, which comes to this. If we are fairly sure that enough life experience translates into wisdom, whatever you mean by that word, but let's just use it. If you're fairly sure that that's what happens, enough life wisdom, enough time on the planet, enough time upright, enough time in the slings and arrows, that wisdom more or less inevitably ensues, you do the math on those two things and you come immediately to the conclusion that this must be the wisest time and place, humanly speaking, that the world has ever seen. And a one-word response to that would be, no, that's not the time we're in. That doesn't describe things even remotely. So something has happened very discernibly in human history, not in the psyche, but in human history, in culture, measurable, learnable, that has had such an enormous consequence for our understanding of experience, that we have come to a point now in the West where we actually mistrust experience on the one side as being something we could inherit, and on the other side, we fetishize personal experience as, quote-unquote, the only reality. Both of these things, it seems to me, are evidence of the absence of wisdom during the proliferation of agedness. There's the dilemma in a nutshell. So my exhortation, as you've asked me, might come down to something like this. I tried to make the case in that book that... that if there's anything to be done, and there is, it may come down to a realization that, first of all, elders are not self-made, nor are they self-designating. I was interviewed by three older people from California one time, several years ago, and they called themselves Elder Radio. So about 10 minutes into the thing, they, you know, already five or six times they'd referred to each other as elders. And then I just happened to ask what I realize now is a fairly cantankerous question. I said, you use this word elder to describe yourself. And they said, yes. And I said, how did that happen? And there was a long pause. And I said, what do you mean? I said to them, I mean, how did you come by this title, this designation, this office that you've claimed for yourself? And there was another pause, and they said, oh, well, that's just what we call each other because nobody else does. So I tell that little vignette to say that I think this is probably a quintessential story of the experience of older people as we sit, you and I sit and talk this evening, that in a general way, older people have been set aside by virtue of being older. And I was in Oaxaca just a couple weeks ago, and I was in a bar, and this woman asked me, so, you know, the standard, what do you do? And I said, well, I just got this book coming out, actually, and what's it about? She said, I told her more or less what I just told you. And she said, so what's your point? I said, we're in trouble, you know. When you have elderhood disappearing in an aging population, you're in deep disarray. And she said, well, I know what happened. You know, I can tell you in one sentence. I said, what's that? She said, well, wisdom abandoned you. And she was about 35, maybe. And she said, we have it now. And I thought to myself, well, there's a sign, if there ever was one, of exactly what I'm talking about, the belief that this kind of life wisdom is a free-floating proposition, that it's given up on old people, and now it's more than willing to settle lightly on the shoulders of people in their 30s. There's never been a culture on the planet, it seems to me, who is willing to entrust the future of the culture to people in their 30s or their you know, chronological equivalent, depending on where you're talking about. I'm not saying that there's not something in age that's inherently of deep running consequence. What I am saying, though, is when you do not have young people seeking out older people, you do not have this function alive in the culture. That ironically, it's younger people against their own inclinations today seeking out elders in their midst that crafts elderhood in the culture. And older people have to have lived their lives as if that day was coming. And it's in both of those cases, I look in vain to find any consistent behavior on either one of those demographics that crafts that ability in the other demographic.
But you do mention that it's really the sort of North American Hinayana-Honky realm that is in the indigenous realm under siege, but still there's a living current that is there. But that's beautifully said. That, you know, yes, elder is not, it's something that is bestowed or earned. That's serious fun. We like that, and beautifully said. So and also just we're winding down, and we're going to think of this as part one, Stephen. But have you seen the movie Coco? No.
I'm in Athens, but I don't get out much, so no, I haven't.
No, that's right. I just want to put that forward as a remarkably beautiful, fabulous, honoring youth and elders movie, such a good sign. And it was popular in Oaxaca, most popular movie in Mexico for 2 months. I just put that there in case you ever venture out into modern cultural vernacular. That would be a good one. But here we are back here. I'm going to reluctantly release you back to Athens at, you know, past midnight, and very kind of you to be such a good guide and sport at this late time, and wonderful that you're journeying outward to guide people about inwardness, which is perfect. Again, off to Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, Shalom, and then San Francisco on April 21st. And people can find out more about that event at orphanwisdom.com. So do you want, is there one last exhortational wish that you'd like to spiral forth into the group mind?
Well, you know, I'm probably not a real cheerleading kind of guy, but I guess I would say that, you know, you could go with the idea that everything's possible, But the elder voice says most of those things aren't likely. Somewhere in between that shortfall, that's where the gold of being a human being is to be found and to be conjured. And would that all of us live long enough to come to an understanding that sounds something like that.
Beautiful. Wonderful enough, and good to meet you even in this initial kind of way. And thank you so much, and to your beautiful team as well, that's been so kind in setting up our logistics. And we will do this again if you're willing. But thank you very much, Stephen
Jenkinson.
Thank you, Jenkinson.
Caroline. Happy to do it. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. OrphanWisdom.com. So that is our great ally. And now let me be a responsible KPFA person, but we have some really great treats. I didn't want to interrupt our ally, Stephen Jenkinson, coming to us from Athens and all. But here we are, right? We're back to the work of elder crafting and youth crafting and dedicated listeners. And so we are offering some enticements. Here's two of my favorites. Okay. It is the Visionary Activist Show tote bag with magic is simply a willingness to cooperate with everything for a pledge of $60. Hey, you can recognize each other. And I use mine all the time. It's thin, it folds up, but it carries a lot. So that's fun. And then here's the cool thing, and we're going to play a little bit of excerpts in some minutes. But due to the miracle, we have excavated the very first Visionary Activist Show, September 5th, 1996, with guest James Hillman. And I have not listened to it since September 5th, 1996, but it's really good. It's really good. Is that Chris's lovely
wife?
Yes.
Yes, hello,
darling.
My dear. I have greatly appreciated you just having someone on about elderhood, if you know what I mean. We're getting closer.
we're getting closer. That's right. And I didn't want
if
to
we're
disturb
lucky.
Our guest's serious dedication. But when people sometimes say, you know, will you be our elder? I'm like, oh, it sounds so frumpy. Yeah. I'll be Maven, you know, and may this station be Maven, which means information resource. It rhymes with Raven. It's just spicier.
Yes.
So I'll think of you, Chris, as a fellow Maven.
Rhymes with Raven. You're right. That's very important.
So we are pitching. You can have the whole recording downloaded. It's 38 minutes of me and James Hillman. We're going to play just a little bit to entice you, but that's for a pledge of $100.
And who is Mr. Hillman?
Oh my goodness! Well, you're going to hear in a moment.
Okay.
It was a coup. It was a great coup for me to score James Hillman as my first guest on September 5th, 1996. Let me just put out the numbers, and then we'll listen to this short clip. Is that
perfect
good with you? And we will. Okay. So it's like a 3-minute clip. But do not be so fascinated, oh dedicated listeners, that you don't call during this clip. 1-800-439-5732. 800-439-5732 or online kpfa.org, and you can have the Visionary Activist tote bag for $60 or this show. Here you go, the first Visionary Activist show, really good. And here's me introducing James Hillman, and I think Erica has it lined up. It's described as a kairos moment, a fulcrum moment where everything that everyone does really matters. So that reminds us of our theme for this show, that we are always voting for reality. And it is always better to create prophecy than live predictions. So into this context, let me introduce our guest, an Aries, therefore a cultural agent provocateur, freed from the illusion of picking one thing and doing it forever. He is the former director of the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, Jungian analyst. He's written a gazillion provocative, complex books that are in the libraries of most of the mythologically, psychically literate people I know. Before this most recent book, his book was written with Michael Ventura. We've had 100 years of psychotherapy and the world's getting worse. His forthcoming book, The Soul's Code, is completely delicious and completely appropriate to what we want to dive into about emerging cosmologies that speak to us. We welcome our first guest consciousness artist, James Hillman. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. That was a grand intro. Go, go, go.
Right. Or as your book actually says, let's get down.
Yeah, let's get down.
Let's get down. Let's get down to get up. There are many, many tasty things in your book. I found it also, having been a great fan of yours for many years, but this is a book in which you maintain your brilliance, but it's also completely tastily accessible. I mean,
it's aimed to be that way.
Right.
It's full of gossip.
Yes.
Stories, anecdotes. The method is anecdotal. Tell people's life stories. I don't mean case histories now. I mean life stories. especially stories of extraordinary people.
And especially, I thought one of the tastiest chapters actually was your chapter on growing down, mm-hmm. that we have this ridiculous fixation on growing up. And in that chapter, you talk about Josephine Baker, who's a completely interesting person. Do you want to tell a little more about Josephine Baker?
Well, Josephine Baker, you know, was born in this outcast hospital in East St. Louis. I mean, right at the bottom of everything for prostitutes, people with social diseases and all that. Her name was changed. She was kept naked by people who, when she was a little girl, she had the most horrible beginning of life. But already then, there was this magic in her. And it's that fact that you have some calling, some innate image that's already there, and it just unfolds and unfolds and unfolds. I mean, I call the thing the acorn theory, that we start with a little nucleus that doesn't ever leave us. Of course, we often go astray and close the door to it and don't hear it, but there's something there.
Right, and I guess also in the astrological language, it's the concept of Venus, that what we have an affinity for is a crucial clue in the spiritual detective novel of our life.
That's good, the detective novel
of
our
life. Yeah, we really want to reverence that. I also thought it was completely interesting that Josephine Baker, and you also talk about Judy Garland, and then somebody you don't talk about, Marilyn Monroe, but all three of them were Geminis.
Yes.
Again, this sort of Venus in America, Gemini fixation. But you contrast very nicely Judy Garland
and Josephine Baker.
And Josephine Baker,
because
right.
Judy Garland tried, she was called at 2.5. She was already a star at 2.5. She couldn't get off the stage. The very first time she ever appeared, she sang Jingle Bells up in Minnesota in a small town with her with her sisters. But she fell down, and the end of her life was a horror. Whereas Josephine Baker entered society, she took on 11 adopted children, she fought for the free French, was awarded medals by De Gaulle, she came back to America and took part in the race revolution.
Working civil rights.
That's right. Yeah. She was really a person who grew slowly down from the heights into the world.
There we have just a little clip of the show from September 5th, 1996, me with James Hillman, and it just gets tastier and tastier, I gotta say, even though I do talk a little bit too much. But we're gonna play a little minute clip in some moments as further enticement with a really great ending. But I've listened to this since we excavated it three times, and I must say, I find it riveting. So we're offering that show as a download, 38 minutes, pretty great. Those of you who love James Hillman, he's an ancestor now, and we had such a great friendship time of cahooting on this show. It was so lovely to hear him again, and this is for a pledge of $100, and we can get it to you pretty fast if you email me that you've already pledged at coyotenetworknews.com. You can do that, because I'd like to get it in people's hands, because it's so pertinent. It's a show that we recorded 22 years ago, and it feels like 20 minutes ago. We talk about immigration, and Americans, and pharmaceuticals, and light and the invisibles and the value of Voodoo and Santeria, and we go everywhere in 38 minutes. So you can have that for a pledge of $100 by calling 1-800-439-5732 or pledging online at kpfa.org. And I'm very enthused to find this originating, and it's like, God, I'm saying the same stuff 22 years later, but but it was really good.
Isn't that good
juicy. Hearing about
it's
Josephine
so
Baker?
I know. Yeah. I love, and I had no idea actually that she had. I mean, I knew some things about her life, and I read about her because I'm fascinated. But I didn't realize the being born where she was born and kept naked as a child. That line. But I love the growing down instead of growing up. Now that I've got these two grandchildren, I'm just trying to protect them from growing up. I find it's fascinating.
Well, it's a good segue from Stephen Jenkinson going, we need more elders, blah, blah, blah. And I have learned over these many years to be a curmudgeon whisperer with, you know, Hillman and Andy Weil and Stephen Brewer. I mean, all going, there you go. But it's a good segue. I think Stephen Jenkinson would go, yes, growing down. Growing down deep. And that's a lot of what this particular show is about, which was great. But also, you know, it's our dedication. And he touches on, you know, the magic in her.
Yes.
And And part of the show is, you know, for all of us listening to go, right, there is a magic in all of us, regardless of the, you know, arduousness of circumstance that can be encouraged and seen. And we talk a lot about Hillman's book, The Soul's Code, the value of being seen. And it's usually not by our parents, but by someone. And then if we're going elderhood or mavenhood, we go, well, what is a gift that we want to give to the world of deeply seeing each other, going, I see your goodness. I see that mission in you.
Speaking
Chris
of
Welsh.
A gift to the world and seeing, let me remind people that this is KPFA in Berkeley,
oh,
et cetera,
you.
Et cetera. And you're listening to Caroline Casey, as you probably do on a weekly basis, the Visionary Activist Show. And this is a fundraising period for KPFA, and Caroline has gotten together a just lovely, delicious little package of things, including the one that she was just talking about, that we were just talking about, James Hillman, her very first program on this radio station. Amazing that you have it. I love it. From 1996 with James Hillman, and as she says, pertinent to this very day. You can have a copy of that to listen to for a $100 donation to KPFA. And then there's her tried and true tote bag, which I must get one. That's a $60 donation to KPFA. And then she's also offering Trickster Training Council seasonal membership, which is a 3-month subscription to weekly ongoing Astromytho Political Phone Web Council with Caroline. And that's for a $200 donation to KPFA. And then another Caroline special, which is her essay, Dreams and Disasters, Patterns of Cultural and Mythological Evolution in the 21st Century. And she is offering that in print form and in an audio recording, both of them together for a $100 donation to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732, online at kpfa.org, the World Wide Web. 1-800-439-5732. And what she, every time she says anything, I'm going, oh, wait, I have to, she's got so much in every sentence. And when you said something about with James Hillman about Venus being your affinity, I thought, oh, my Venus is in Pisces. I'm going to have to go look what that means. So
It's exalted, Chris. You have an exalted. That's where Venus is now. You're having your Venus return. Never have you been so charismatically gorgeous.
Ooh.
Right, but let me squeeze in this.
Yes, please do.
You be my co-guide here. But there's we have a minute and a half clip, which is
it is
me talking maybe a little too much, but I was giddy then. But it is a minute and a half, and it's got a great ending, and we'll just slip it in right now if that's okay with you.
That's the problem with the melting pot. We want to take the chilies out of it and turn it all into corn chowder.
Right. And again, see, the subversive thing, I think, that this is, all of this is great, is that, well, I often underpress myself by walking down the street and going, okay, everyone has a Neptune, everyone has a yearning, a
That's
dream,
it.
Everyone
That's
has
right.
a Uranus, a unique part. Talk to that, bypass
everyone
their conscious mind.
Everyone has a Pluto.
Everyone has a Pluto.
Yeah.
Yes,
that
absolutely.
Pluto, that there again, if we come in touch with that seed that's so mysterious.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to speak to that and to invite that, and even though Pluto, of course, is expensive wisdom, somebody who was having, I was talking to somebody with, Pluto very strong in their life, and they said, do you know the Japanese poem that says, since my house burned down, I have a much better view of the rising moon? And that's Pluto's gift.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, everyone has that. But I think the subversive part is, again, when we speak to that and pitch it,
yes,
even invisibly, we just invisibly talk to that part of it. It is hungry, it quickens, it wakes up, and it won't go back to sleep, and it won't let that person go back to sleep.
Exactly.
Which I think also about you lobbing this book. I mean, part of what I say about Uranus and Aquarius is that it is time to lob liberating esoterica into mainstream.
And but you see what happens.
Well, what
Simply,
happens?
Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton does one little conversation with imaginary Eleanor Roosevelt,
right,
and she's scoffed.
Right.
Well, of course, that's part of the attack on Hillary Clinton and all. But there's still in this white bread culture a terrible fear.
Yeah.
A terrible, straight-laced, peculiar fear.
Well, let's kick it open.
Good.
All right, there we have. Let's kick it open, team. Good. And I just, you know,
Ooh, I want to hear more from him. I want to hear more
about him. You do. That was me talking a little too much, but it was really good, and it's such a great ending. Let's kick it open. Good. And I love hearing him chortle. People really do love James Hillman, and this is a good way to introduce him to many people. But I do promise that the rest of the show, which we're offering as a download, that 38 minutes, that he has plenty to say about progressives being more effective, about the value of immigration, about, you know, growing down, about the soul's code, about seeing any. It's very nutrient rich, and he did chortle, and he had lots to say, but we had such a great friendship, really. And anyway, I love, you know, hearing James Hillman chortle is pretty great. So we're offering that as a download. It's the very first Visionary Activist show, September 5th, 1996, and it's incredibly pertinent to now. Oh, my lordy.
And it can be yours with a $100 donation to KPFA when you call 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-KPFA, and, of course, online at kpfa.org. Caroline, you're so brilliant. I just love listening to you. So I'm just going to give the phone number once in a while.
Yeah. That's great. No, let's see. We're winding down. We've got our waning moments
of
pitching.
Fewer than five minutes left here.
I know. And so I did want Stephen Jenkinson really wanted a whole show. And I go, you get 40 minutes and we're just doing that. And now Chris and I will pitch and we're going to prove that this is okay to give you a real show and then exhort. Because we are exhorting with enthusiasm. And I do love, exactly. So jaunty of death and, yes, adorable text messages coming in. But oh, wonderful, dedicated listeners. I'm really just sort of pitching right now in the waning time that my two currently easy and favorite profferings, thank you gifts, which is the Visionary Activist Purple Tote Bag. Magic is simply a willingness to cooperate with everything. Holds a lot of groceries, you know, and a six-pack of organic ginger ale. And then we're also offering the Visionary Activist First Show with James Hillman. It's a 38-minute download. We send you the link for a pledge of $100 just because it's the beginning of the whole thing. It's me. Here we are, 22 years later. And it is time for us to apply everything that we've been cultivating in these last 22 years. And I go, God, I really was myself 22 years ago. Amazing. But anyway, so yes, by calling 1-800-439-5732 and pledging online, kpfa.org.
You've got these two shows, your very first show ever with James Hillman, we've just heard a little bit of, for a $100 donation. Then you've got your essay in both print and on audio, The Dreams and Disasters, Patterns of Cultural and Mythological Evolution into the 21st Century. And then you've got the swag to carry it in, your tote bag, the purple tote bag. And then you have not the past, but into the future, the training, the seasonal membership of the Compassionate Trickster Experimental Juju Mystery School. What more could you possibly ask for? And that's a 3-month subscription, weekly, ongoing phone and web counsel with Caroline for a $200 donation. It's a real, she's such a gift. And this is a big gift too, even off air. 1-800-439-5732. We hope that you'll appreciate the 59,000 watts of power that comes over which Caroline floats or appears or manifests.
That's very cute. 59,000 watts of power.
Yeah.
And we are all in this dream together. So there are so many great dedicated listeners. I hear from you a lot. We also have listeners in prison. Pledge for them. We have listeners who are enthusiastic dogs. Pledge for them. We have listeners who are homeless. Pledge for them. We have listeners who are prosperous. Feel free to donate $50,000, $5, $50,000. All are welcome at 800-439-5732 or online, kpfa.org. And by pledging, you will be making a magical commitment that says we can really have a non-haranguing, you know, fun drive show with a real show. And then Chris and I delightfully, you know, Chris Welch is such a valuable member of the KPFA team, and it's wonderful to dance with you. It is. And we
tip-toeing
are all
tiptoeing through the tulips. Yes.
Oops, there we go. All too soon. I hope we did okay. I hope we were responsible and raised a bazillion dollars. But you can still chime in right now as we're on our way out. Thanks very much to Erica Bridgman, always our great Skookum board op, and again